Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the second Empire Podcast Review of the Year, following on from last year's, which was the first Empire Podcast Review of the Year. The year we're reviewing today is, Rolls Tombola, 2013! Hooray! Hooray! And to join me in arbitrarily awarding the star ratings that half of you are going to disagree with, violently and vehemently, are Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
Hello. Nick DeSimulian.
Hello.
Hello. Dan Jolin.
It is I.
And me, hello. Needless to say, we shall be discussing spoilers over here. It is a review of the year. To do so adequately, we have to sometimes go into the nitty-gritty of big movies and small movies alike. So for the next 2 hours or so, you might want to cover your ears, which defeats the purpose of listening to a podcast in the first place.
You didn't think that through.
No, but I so seldom do. Where should we start? How about a few of the year overall? As Jane Spencer says to Frank Drebin in The Naked Gun, soon to be remade and obviously bettered and improved.
Oh.
Good year? No, the worst. But it wasn't the worst, or it wasn't the best. Well, I kind of thought this year was a bit middling, to be honest. What did you think?
I am inclined to agree with you, which is the first time for everything. No, I think there were absolutely definite highlights, but also, you know, it wasn't one of those years that blows you away. It wasn't one of those years where you look back over it and you're like, there were so many films there that were incredible. I think there were incredible films, and especially this Oscar season, half of which unhelpfully are coming out in January and February, but it's a really good, strong Oscar season. But it didn't feel overall like this is a year that's going to go down in history with, you know, 1939, 1999, and other years without a nine in the name.
Odd years are always the best.
Isn't that Star Trek films?
But no, years. Years.
That's the opposite of Star Trek films.
Yeah. It's like 1993 was an amazing year. 1999 was an amazing year.
1997 was an amazing year.
Yeah.
Event Horizon.
Oh, okay, let's just...
And there were some other films that released that year? No, it was a really good year. There was Event Horizon, LA Confidential. So what did you think of the year?
It's really hard to sum it all up. It's kind of like, you know, looking back on any year, there's some good, there's some bad. I mean, you know, as we will discuss, there were some crushing disappointments and there were some pleasant surprises. I suppose it's ultimately about how your expectation was managed, or at least how your expectation affected what you saw. You know what I mean? If you start the year looking forward to tons and tons of things, it's like, oh, great, they're making The Lone Ranger. And then you hear everyone saying, The Lone Ranger stinks. And then you're like, actually, that was pretty good. You know, it's a roller coaster ride, Chris. It was a roller coaster ride.
On acid.
It was a roller coaster. Oh, I wish.
That's two of Dan's banned phrases from Empire Features.
Yes, so. as his hidden gems, which I believe is going to be said at some point during this podcast.
You just did. We will be saying it again later on. Nick, what did you think of this year? Because I think if you compile for example, my top 10 of the year has about two, maybe three five-star films on it. And there are a bunch of five-star films that are, annoyingly, as you said, Helen, scheduled for 2014 already, which are coming out in the States in 2013, which might have made the picture a bit more lopsided. I thought this year was a bit rotten otherwise.
It was for bigger films, I think. If you look at the big tentpole blockbusters, I don't think it was a particularly good year. Iron Man 3, I really enjoyed.
Yep.
Other than that, I'd say, you know, Man of Steel, Star Trek 2, both slight disappointments. Some people like them more than others, but generally the consensus is they weren't sort of classics. Elysium I found a little bit disappointing. Pacific Rim was okay, but again, it's not like an evergreen classic.
I think the summer blockbusters were, with the exception of Iron Man 3, I would agree, disappointing. Even Fast and Furious 6, my goodness. But I think the winter blockbusters have been better. You know, we've liked Hobbit, we liked Hunger Games, we liked Thor, and that's kind of saved the blockbuster kind of honour for the year for me anyway. A little bit.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, but it's not been a great year for action films.
True.
What about Oscar films? Not just the ones that... Because, again, painting a slightly lopsided picture of the year, I've almost ignored January, which is where all the Oscar films from last year were scheduled for this year. So we had Zero Dark Thirty and Django Unchained and Lincoln and Les Mis, and they all came out in January. Have they stood the test of time? Do they rescue 2013 in a way?
Lincoln was my top film of the year. I absolutely adored that. And
that was genuine. That wasn't just inspired by your love of beards.
It wasn't inspired by my love of beards nor my devotion to Spielberg, although both, I'll be honest, played a factor. But I love those kind of procedural films. I love films about smart people being smart. I love, you know, idealism, Abraham Lincoln and Daniel Day-Lewis. And so it was pretty much, you know, catnip for me.
Perfect storm.
Yeah.
Dan, what about you?
Well, from the early stuff.
Yeah.
The early stuff. I mean,
that tends to be overlooked.
It does tend to be overlooked. I mean, I'd actually say for me, Zero Dark Thirty, I caught it quite late and I was really disappointed by it. I actually did not like it.
Why?
It seemed to be a kind of an excuse for the death penalty, and it just seemed to be a film purely about retribution, and it just bugged me. Got up my nose.
Wasn't the point, though, that kind of that, you know, retribution isn't good necessarily? The last scene was a little bit ambiguous.
Yeah, it is ambiguous. So I took it as that she's just like, she's got nothing left. She's achieved it. She's got nothing left. Mm. And I took it more as that interpretation of the ending. But, you know, on the positive side, trying to think, what were the early ones of the year? Obviously, Lincoln was great. Cloud Atlas wasn't an Oscar film, but I really loved it. That was early on. That was February, wasn't it?
I mean, it was one of those great ones where you applaud the ambition as much as anything else, and just the sheer dizzying approach to an unfilmable book. To do an unfilmable book in an unfilmable way is pretty ballsy.
And
for all its shortcomings, and it does have shortcomings, you've got to applaud that.
I absolutely love that. I keep meaning to watch it again, but that running time just and then I can't remember what were the other ones. Nick?
Well, January
Django.
Django, yes, great.
Django, yeah, it's, I don't know, I tried to watch it again recently and I kind of lost interest about half an hour, and I really enjoyed it when I saw it the first time.
Mm.
But it's not up there with the A Tarantino movies, is it?
It's funny because I said this in my review, it's too long, but not because I have anything inherently against long films. I love Cloud Atlas, but because it doesn't feel like it has the story for that running time. Mm. And it does seem to just sort of runs out of story, it feels like to me. Towards the end. But that said, I think it's still on my top 10 of the year. It is still on my top 10 of the year. So, hooray.
Don Johnson's my favourite thing about that.
Ah, Christoph Waltz. I know, obvious, but yeah.
Yeah, he's amazing, isn't
it? Yeah.
I'm not sure he was second Oscar amazing, but he was fantastic in it.
Yeah.
Great soundtrack as well. We'll be on the soundtracks of the year later on. Also in January, there was The Impossible, Juan Antonio Bayona's Impossible. Which may be the film that bagged him the World War Zed cool gig. So I love that film. It was on my top 10 of the year. It probably still is. If you've picked up the most recent issue of Empire Magazine, it has all of our top 10s in it. Due to print schedules and whatnot, we had to write those top 10s in early November, which is always fun. A lot of us hadn't seen The Hobbit. Walter Mitty. I still haven't seen Walter Mitty. What else? Anchorman 2. No one else had seen Anchorman 2 apart from me.
Yeah, you were the only one who'd seen it at that point.
I was the only one who'd seen it at that point.
Nebraska, I think. No, it had screened, but I hadn't seen it when I wrote my list, and it would have been on my top 10 if
American
I'd seen
Hustle.
It. American Hustle? American Hustle, none of us had seen at
hadn't
that,
seen that
time.
One. That's a weird one that comes out in London on December 20th, but comes out in the rest of the UK on January 3rd. So is it a 2013 film or 2014 film? I don't know. It's trying to have the best of both worlds, isn't it? Mm. Cheeky.
Let's say it's a 2014 film.
But yeah, so our top 10s are kind of, they're not really set in stone, but what I've always been intrigued is, would a film that you've seen subsequently gatecrash your top 10? And for me, so far, I don't think I've seen anything either that I had missed beforehand or subsequently that would be on the top 10.
There's a couple of films I still have to catch up on DVD, which might well end up in there. I'm hearing great things about The Kings of Summer, and to my shame, I have not seen it yet. So possibly. But I think the whole idea of top 10s is inherently stupid, so I don't know what I'm doing here. Oh, God.
That's not dwelling on top 10s.
Yeah.
That's not dwelling on top 10s. We're just picking the best things of the year.
Okay.
That's all we're doing.
Phew.
It's not stupid at all. Shall we go through? I've got a list of categories here. And let's just go through them one by one then. See if we can impose some order on proceedings. Actor of the year. Is this actor or man of the year? And then we'll obviously do actress and woman of the year next. So what's our thinking in that? Who really stood out for you this year?
Well, obviously, if we're talking actor, Daniel Day-Lewis, I mean, I hate to be obvious, but I had to keep reminding myself I wasn't watching Abraham Lincoln, and I'm not usually that delusional. In terms of pure acting, that.
I had the same thing with Benjamin Walker and Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter.
I mean, it was an underrated performance. His performance was not what was wrong with that film. You know,
No, that's very true. And it's good to see he's actually still getting work. because I would have thought that movie might have been a death knell for pretty much everyone involved. Also, Dominic Cooper's getting a lot of work these days.
Which
is good. You know, if you go down your local Dole office, you'll see half the cast of Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. It's a very, very sad state of affairs. That is a phenomenal performance, it has to be said. But what about other people who've stood out this year? I mean, I thought Tom Hanks had a...
Two great performances in one great film and one not very great film, but two great performances.
Yeah, Toy Story of Terror and and Captain Phillips.
And Saving Mr. Banks.
And that's right.
Yes.
And there's a third.
Yes. Can you guess which I think is the great film and the not so great film out of those two?
Knowing you, yes.
Is it Captain Phillips?
Captain Phillips is awesome.
There we go.
Saving Mr. Banks is about half a good film.
Okay.
About half of
the bank heist. Is that the best bit?
They save the bank heist.
Yes.
Yeah. No. Hanks again. It kind of feels too obvious, doesn't it? Daniel Day-Lewis, Tom Hanks. It's we're not. So let's say someone a bit different. Daniel Brühl.
Daniel Brühl.
How about that?
Very good in Rush.
Yeah.
Creme brulee.
Amazing, amazing performance in Rush. And all right then, Barkhad Abdi.
For Captain Phillips as well.
For Captain Phillips. Actually, yes.
Stop talking about Captain Phillips.
Sorry.
We'll be nominating the boat next.
Michael Douglas, I'm saying, and Matt Damon. Actually,
and Captain
both
Phillips.
Of them. Both of them for Beyond the Candelabra.
Behind.
Okay.
Behind, sorry. Beyond is the sequel. Actually, Scott Thorson had a very interesting life post Liberace, and I think they should actually make a sequel and call it Beyond the Candelabra, starring Matt Damon, showing what happened to Thorson, because it was nuts.
Am I allowed to say Dean Norris from Breaking Bad?
Breaking Bad's kind of
in every
thing,
category,
isn't it?
Hidden gem.
In every category, actress of the year.
Yep.
Dean Norris,
he wins them all.
He is awesome. Is he the best thing out of Breaking Bad for you? Is he the standout?
I think if you're talking about this year, yeah.
I'm sure I've said this in the podcast before, but one of the things I love about Dean Norris is he's one of those guys where if you go back and watch loads of old movies, when I say old movies, dear God, I'm raging ourselves here, but the movies from the 80s and 90s.
Paul Verhoeven movies mainly.
He'll pop up.
Yeah.
He's in Total Recall.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Starship Troopers.
But he played, and I think I've said this in the podcast before, but such a good fact, I'm going to say it again. He played a character called SWAT Team Leader in both Terminator 2 and Gremlins 2. I think that's the same guy.
Shared universe,
which means is he still around? Dean Norris could, next summer, Dean Norris is SWAT team leader, tackling Mogwais and Gremlins. Why would he tackle a Mogwai? That's horrible. Shooting Mogwai, killing innocent Mogwai.
Well, actually, to be fair, if you kill the Mogwai, you solve the problem.
You do. Now, here's another question. Is Gizmo the only Mogwai? Or is there another Mogwai?
There is another Mogwai.
But it grows up and becomes...
Yoda.
No, Helen, and I'll tell you why.
Shared universe.
No, because Star Wars takes place a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
Yeah, but it's an ancestor. Mm. Like, he's born a Mogwai, and then he grows. As long as he doesn't eat after midnight or get wet, which is difficult living on a swamp planet, then you grow up and you get a little bit more gremlin-like as you go older, and you get the greenish colouring and you lose your fur, but basically he's a Mogwai.
I'm sold.
Robbie the Robot is in Forbidden Planet and Gremlins. I don't know what that means, but I'm going to say it.
Amazing.
I feel like we may have...
Oh, you mean
track.
The film Forbidden Planet, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Warner Brothers just texted me. They want that pitch.
Well, let's get going.
There you go. $4 billion is our ASCII price, as always. Chris Hemsworth had a great year.
Yes.
I know it's a bit dull and predictable to say that, but I think in Rush he showed that he could do something else than a posh English guy. No, hang on. He showed he had range, which was good. Mm. And you know, he's just one of those rare things, isn't he? He's a ready-made movie star.
Yeah.
Just walking on this. And when you see his brother... in The Hunger Games, you just see the contrast between the two of them. He's not quite there yet, is he, Liam? Poor Liam.
He's got a little bit of a way to go. I would also say, again, at the risk of being predictable, Hugh Jackman started off
Who?
The year with a huge box office success with Les Mis, showing off his pipes once again.
I beg your pardon? Did you see the uncut version?
I think he said he made the Wolverine movie he intended to make all along with the Wolverine. It yes, had a little then, bit more success
but
than
But then
his
we accidentally deleted the last reel. We had to shoot it again in five minutes.
It had some things going for it, and then Prisoners. He's actually very, very good in Prisoners, and again, that allows him to show a little bit more dramatic range.
I watched that yesterday morning. I thought that was terrific.
Yeah.
I wasn't expecting much because I actually thought the trailer we talk about trailers later, I thought that was one of the worst trailers of the year in terms of, I just watched it and went, I don't want to see this film. Made it look really generic, but I thought the film was fantastic. And he was extremely good in a really dark role.
Can't have an Empire podcast without mentioning The Rock and Tom Hiddleston.
Wouldn't dream of it.
Probably the same person. I'd never seen them in the same room together. They had both had cracking years, I think.
G.I. Joe Retaliation.
Okay, one
partially
of them had cracking years.
And,
you know, looking at, I'm not sure if this person had a really good year or not, but let's mention James Franco, because again, in the current issue of Empire, the one that's just about to go off sale as you listen to this, most helpfully, we have a pie chart that I took a long time to compile, which breaks down James Franco's multiple pursuits this year. So he wasn't just acting in movies and writing in movies and producing movies and directing movies. He was producing artwork and writing books and writing novels and in a band, and he was on this TV show and that TV show.
Do you know what he wasn't doing, though? Do you know what he wasn't doing? Do you know which film he's very notably wasn't working on?
No.
Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
That's true.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. Sorry, that's a little bit of a 2014 preview in there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, people know
no
that.
No Franco.
People know that he's not in that.
Well, they might not know that.
Well, they know now.
What do you know about it?
It was a semi-bombshell. It was a very small bombshell.
Yes, it was a grenade shell.
Fans of Rise of the Planet of the Apes will be outraged when they learn that whatever his character was called will not be back.
Yes, Will Rodman being a reference to Rod Serling.
Dennis Rodman.
Who wrote the script of the original Planet of the Apes.
That's a silly reference.
Will Rodman. Dead.
Just call the character Rod Serling.
Dead.
He's dead.
He's dead. He's dead.
How did he die?
Slipped on a banana skin. The monkey virus. The monkey virus killed him dead. Anyway, that's what James Franco was not doing. So there you go.
I'm going to put a shout out to James McAvoy, who I thought had a really good year.
Hooray!
Yeah.
A good old sort of doubleheader with Filth and Trance, which I loved.
Yep.
And I thought that between those two films, he got to show quite a lot of range.
Filth, which I saw recently on a plane. I hadn't seen Filth before, and it didn't quite get crushed my top 10 of the year, but it was very, very good. But I saw it on a plane, and the stewardess came to serve me, and I paused it. And just at the scene where James McAvoy and Shirley Henderson having frantic phone sex with each other, and I paused it just as their faces are like,
and then you rewound it and pointed lasciviously. The captain was called out.
Yes,
emergency landing.
Yes,
he was also on stage in Macbeth and very good there as well. So yeah, good year all around for McAvoy.
And he was filming X-Men: Days of Future Past
which is looking pretty darn good for 2014.
Good. He's back McAvoy. he hasn't got away.
He never really went anywhere, did he?
All right. We need him to go away for a while, so that will work.
Yeah, go away, James McAvoy. But then come back again, because we like you. Who else had a good year? Who was on a lot of stuff? Oh, Steve Coogan was in everything. I'm surprised he's not in this podcast, to be honest.
That's true, three films.
Four.
Four films.
Four films.
And and a couple of them, quite big hits. Philomena has done brilliantly well.
It has. I remember whenever Damon Wise first saw that movie, and he wrote me an email saying, Steve Coogan's going to get nominated for an Oscar for this movie. And I went, ha! What? Nonsense! But I think he might, for screenplay at least, alongside Jeff Pope. That seems to be the way the tide is turning for that movie. So, yeah, that's great. And obviously, Alan Partridge, Alpha Papa. We got over a disappointment about the fact it wasn't called Alan Partridge, Colossal Velocity. And I thought it was the second or third funniest film of the year.
Which he has said several times in interviews, including to us.
Mm. Yeah.
He wanted it to be called Alan Partridge, Colossal Velocity. Who is overruling Steve Coogan when it comes to Partridge?
Crazy. Presumably Iannucci, but, you know, it just makes no sense.
Mm. Okay, so woman / actress of the year. Let's go actress of the year first and have performances. Helen, you've raised your hand.
I have.
Helen.
Surely the woman of the year in terms of actresses has got to be Jennifer Lawrence. Winning an Oscar for last year's Silver Linings Playbook, or at least last year in the US. I think it was here as well last year. Then following that up with a massive box office success for the second Hunger Games movie. The first one was successful, this one is more so. And finishing up with an incredibly eye-catching turn in American Hustle, which suggests she might be in line for another Oscar, certainly nomination, if not win.
And she flipped the bird.
And she flipped the bird to the bird. Oscar press corps, which, frankly, we've got to support.
Yeah, she launched approximately 8 billion GIFs or GIFs this year.
Yeah.
She is phenomenal. Pretty much every interview she does is generates 1,000 brilliant quotes. Yeah. She's just awesome.
Yeah. I think a lot of people are going to be saying Science Oven in 2014.
I believe so as well. And you will understand that when you've seen American Hustle.
She's fantastic. And hey! She was also filming Days of Future Past not too long ago.
Wow.
Who wasn't?
That's true.
Well.
Pretty
hands,
much everybody.
Hands up if you're not in Days of Future Past. We've all kept our hands down. That's very interesting. Very interesting indeed. Should we keep this category open? Does anyone else even come close
to
Jennifer Lawrence?
Yes,
okay,
yes.
Dan.
I have a shout. I have a shout for someone. Brie Larson.
Yes.
Brie Larson. Absolutely superb. Yeah, because she's absolutely amazing in Short Term 12. I actually think that's my performance by an actress of the year over Blue Jasmine. Yes, absolutely superb. But she sort of, Brie Larson kind of pops up in a lot of things. She was great in Don John in a very small role as well. And I can't off the top of my head think of any others she did this year, but I'm sure there's at least another one.
Not that I know of this year. Obviously, most people, I think, still remember her from Scott Pilgrim versus the World, where she was Envy Adams.
That's right.
But also, I mean, she's a thoroughly nice person who totally deserves the amount of success she's currently getting. So hopefully this leads to many more big things for her.
I hope so.
I feel really sorry for Naomi Watts. She started the year so well with The Impossible. I thought she was absolutely brilliant in that. Unfortunately, she then made Diana.
Yeah.
Which is not getting a whole lot of Oscar talk. But I have a lot of time for Naomi Watts.
I
think you do well at the Razzies.
She might do well at the Razzies,
I don't know. That film obviously got a kick in over here, but I think it's got less of a kick in everywhere else. I mean, it died an absolute death at the box office. Possibly a poor choice of phrase.
Not a lot of people did go into the Garden of Love in the end.
No, God, dear. No, the admission fee was just prohibitive, I believe. You'd have to watch the film. Nobody wants to see that.
I think the other two actresses we should mention this year are Melissa McCarthy and Sandra Bullock. Now, obviously, they worked together on The Heat, which was a very big hit in the US box office and a slightly lesser one, but still solid one over here. But also independently, McCarthy also opened Identity Thief really big in the US, and of course Bullock made a little film called Gravity, which did quite well.
Is that the first mention of it in this podcast?
So far, but I'm pretty sure it won't be the last.
Yes.
It's interesting, I didn't lump it in with the rest of the action films that I was saying it was not a great year for action, but that is action film.
It's the year's best action film.
It is.
And it's not even an action film.
Indeed.
Or is it?
Discuss, 10 points.
Yeah.
This is quite interesting. Earlier on, just as we were about to start recording the podcast, I did a shout out on Twitter. I said, you know, we're recording it right now. Do you have any questions for us? We have loads.
Hooray.
Loads of questions. So instead of going through some of my categories, we will come back to the categories later on. But let's go through some of the questions here and see what we can see. So at TomoJ03 asks, best use of music in a film this year? I'd say Bowie in Frances Ha.
Next.
Done. Thanks, James Thompson. What do we think?
One word. Rochford.
Yes, that is a superb scene.
Yeah, which was actually something that came really late to the film because I was on set when they were doing it, and they were literally coming up with that idea halfway through the shoot. Originally, it was going to start with a big dream sequence, which they scrapped. So it was.
It didn't have a big Bond-style credit sequence as well.
Yeah,
which just went by the wayside.
Yeah, and they were playing the Rochford tune on set, going, "Oh, this could work. This could work." So they hadn't yet shot it. Yeah,
so just to be clear, we're talking about Alpha Papa for
indeed.
Anyone who wasn't 100%.
Not Philomena.
Alan Partridge's Alpha Papa, which is fantastic despite its ramshackle nature. There is a sense that film is being held together by masking tape and bits of Pritt stick. Mm. But it is really, really funny, which is very Partridge-esque in its own little way.
Mm. Yeah.
Maybe a shout out for Let's Go Fly a Kite in Saving Mr. Banks, which I think, you know, was the most moving kind of moment of that film in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The World's End has lots of great musical moments. I probably have to go for the use of This Corrosion over any of the others because, you know, anything that sort of gives the Sisters of Mercy at their most preposterously epic gets my vote.
I was delighted to see Teenage Fan Club being included on there after their banner year last year with the concept being used again and again and again and again and again in young adult. I was delighted to see that What You Do to Me was on the soundtrack. It's a fantastic soundtrack, World's End. Probably my favourite of the year, I would say.
The two soundtracks I've had on rotation the most heavily the last few months, Stoker is still brilliant, I think. It's got a great Nancy Sinatra track, Summer Wine, on there, which I was not familiar with. And Gravity, which I think is Stephen Price. Fantastic soundtrack. If you're on the tube, makes it a lot more exciting. Thinking debris is going to come in.
God.
Every time you get to Harrow on the Hill. But yeah, those two soundtracks don't get old. Oh, and Trance, Rick Smith's Trance.
Yeah, that was great. That was great.
Which has no Trance music on it, really, but still good.
For Song of the Hour, I was going to say, Can You Dig It from Iron Man 3.
Absolutely.
Which we've been bopping around to a lot in the office.
Yep, we devised a dance routine, didn't we?
Yes, we did, yeah.
Called The Repulsor.
That's right.
Yeah. I love, though, that the Iron Man 3 opens with one of the worst songs of the 90s. And it's just, like, completely random, but it's just, like, it just kicks in. You're just like, what the... What's... You know, it's just... and also, actually, while we're on the Marvel films...
Blue by Euro... I can't remember, what are they called?
Yeah, 99.
I hate that song. It works ironically.
It's just one of that kind of really bad glut of kind of, you know, sub Ibiza pop trance things going on at that time, in the pre auto tune days. Also, actually, Marvel Films' use of a song, the Exhibit song that is Natalie Portman's ringtone. I like that.
That was very funny.
Yeah.
I like, because I'm thinking of work. It's probably going to be up by the time you're listening to this podcast, but I'm working on a Empire Christmas movie songs playlist on our Spotify account at the moment. And there are a couple at the beginning of Iron Man 3 where Tony Stark kind of has his robots queue up, as DJs queue up a couple of Christmas tracks, and one of them's Jingle Bells by, I think, Herb Alpert and Tijuana Brass Band, I think. I need to double check that one, but that's quite a funky little version of Jingle Bells, which I quite liked. But yes, Can You Dig It was never, for a long time, it was the song I had on repeat constantly. And it's got elements, if you listen to it, it's got elements of the 30 Rock theme tune. Lots of people in the background going do-do-do-do-do-do.
Worst soundtrack of the year, I'm going to nominate Flight. Which
most on the nose soundtrack, surely.
If you go online, Vulture, the website Vulture has done a track by track breakdown of what the tune is and how the action on screen relates to the lyrics.
Under the bridge. Oh, she's taking heroin. Let's put on Under the Bridge. Oh,
and don't forget Whit Whitaker's Soul Funk mixtape with Marvin Gaye on it.
It's a good film, Flight.
No, it's not. It's not. No, it's not.
No, it is. I like it.
No, it's not.
It is.
It isn't. Really.
It is. You're an idiot. No.
No, it's a good opening sequence with a crap movie of the week tacked on the end.
It's hard not to argue with that.
It's got a CG tier. Come on. What else do you want?
Yeah. It's got a bit where a man flies a plane upside down.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's awesome. It's over in the first 20
minutes.
Was it more
after that? Because I was really jet-lagged
myself. Some people did some talking and then stuff.
Yeah. Happened. Honestly, once he lands the plane, switch it off. But you'll have seen a great short film.
A quirky little indie short film.
Yeah.
Any other films I got that might have been improved had you stopped watching them after 20 minutes?
Elysium.
Man of Steel.
Would have, yes.
Man of Steel, probably. After that.
No, I don't
bonkers
agree with that.
Krypton sequence. And then it comes to Earth and becomes very prosaic and dull, and people start punching each other through buildings. Endlessly.
Anyway, the best use of a song. What happens to that?
Sorry. Let's go back. Sorry. Yes. What do we think?
The Bling Ring as well. I mean, Sofia Coppola's soundtracks are always pretty good as well.
Good soundtrack.
Yeah.
I liked that. I came out and looked up Sleigh Bells straight afterwards.
All right.
Great Sleigh Bells track.
You saucy devil. Are we done with music?
Well, sure. There is one song of the year, although I have to hold my hand up. I haven't actually seen the film it's in, but I love the song, so can I say it?
Sure.
Because I haven't yet seen Blue is the Warmest Colour, which I actually really quite embarrassed about, and I really want to see it. I Follow Rivers, the Magician remix by Licky Lee. I'm probably saying that wrong.
That is
amazing.
No, I think you said remix.
And it's
correctly.
Honestly, it's just in my head all the time.
I've had that track on my iPod for about 3 years.
Yeah, I know it's not a recent song, but it's just it's recently come to me via the knowledge that it was in that film.
Two more, very, very quickly, both from Pixar. I love Gospel by the March 4th Marching Band, which is at the end of Monsters University, is also used at a montage, during a montage rather, about halfway through the film, and it's really funky and poppy and fun. At the beginning of Monsters University, there's a Blue Umbrella, which has this lovely, lilting, gorgeous little piece of music by, I think, Sashka Unseld, I should have looked this up, but John Brown wrote the music as well. But that's fantastic if you can check that one out. Let's move on to other questions now. What we got? Liam Canning at 92 Cannonball asks, what's the one film released this year that we might think differently of in 5 years' time?
Intriguing.
This is a job interview question, isn't it?
None of those.
Where do you see Gravity in 5 years' time? Still
around
us all?
So hang on, ask the question again. What's the wording in the question?
What's the one film released this year we might think differently of in 5 years' time?
Gravity is an interesting one, because I was pondering that. It's so amazing when you see it on the big screen in 3D. how is that film going to be when you see it again on DVD?
Yeah.
I think that, more than any other film this year, is potentially going to suffer from... It's just the hugeness of it.
I think it has other strengths, though, than its visual, you know, qualities. Mm. You know, I refuse to accept that there is any film that's great in 3D that can't be great in 2D.
And I think, I mean, it will lose some of its immersiveness that really gets you in the cinema, but at the same time, it still does have that just propulsive tension about it the whole way through, which I think is probably going to stand up. I mean, we will obviously see. We have seen, you know, it is always the peril with sort of films that push the technological envelope that sometimes a few years down the line, they look pretty weak by comparison. But I think that one probably has enough meat in the sandwich to keep us going, as it were.
Yeah.
I wonder if... Sometimes we're kind of forgiving of things when they're new, and I wonder if, you know, we're going to... I can see, for example, Star Trek Into Darkness becoming one of those films that is hated or certainly disliked.
I was disappointed.
Well, I was disappointed in the first place, but I think people are going to get more harsh towards it as time goes on.
I think that's happened already.
Yeah, well, okay, good. I was there from day one. I just like to make that clear.
Yeah, I wasn't terribly far behind you on that one either. Well, obviously the Star Trek fans who were polled at some sort of Star Trek convention a few months ago said it was the worst Star Trek film of all time. It isn't.
Which is crazy.
It isn't.
Anyone who's seen Final Frontier knows that's not the case, but it's not the best.
But I think that film makes... It drops an awful lot of balls.
It is an awful lot of balls.
Well, hang on, I can resist that.
I said it was a disappointment. I didn't say it was a terrible film.
I like the space jump quite a bit. I would say that's one of the best action scenes of the year.
Yeah, as long as Klingons are in it and Khan isn't, it's great.
It is tricky. I mean, which films are we going to reevaluate? Which films? And I'm going to say this, and you're going to disagree with me and throw things at me and call me an idiot. But hey, you do that every week anyway. I think Oblivion in 5 years' time is going to be looked back at as potentially a very, very good slice of sci-fi.
I really enjoyed
it. The visuals in that movie are astonishing. It may be my favorite sci-fi film of the summer. Of the year. Sorry, not the summer. Of the year.
I would have cast Nikolai Coster-Waldau as the lead, though, and I wouldn't have put Tom Cruise in it.
I think it would have been a very different film had that happened.
Yeah, a really handsome one.
Yes,
yeah.
It wouldn't have got made for a start.
True.
I was a bit annoyed by Tom Cruise's haircut in that film. I thought he should have had a bit more of a dystopian haircut. I thought, you know, he still had the same neat trim. Who's doing his hair?
Well, presumably they have hair cutting machines.
I need to see that scene.
Do you really need to see that scene? Do you need to see that scene?
No.
Are we an effective team?
Okay, all right.
We are not an effective team. I think in 5 years' time, honestly, we're going to look back at Olympus Has Fallen, because by that point we'll have had the trilogy. London Has Fallen, followed by Blackpool Has Fallen. The budget's getting lower and lower and lower. And we'll see, you know, this is a really good action trilogy, guys. Mike Banning is one of the great action. I can't even keep a straight face during that one.
London Has Fallen, will he play a game of Bugger Off? Has to happen.
You go first.
In London Has Fallen... London has fallen.
London has fallen.
London has fallen.
London Bridge is falling down.
London has fallen.
That would
fallen.
Have been a better title.
It would be. But yeah. London Has Fallen. Can Gerard Butler please just use his real accent? Can he just be revealed as some sort of undercover Scot?
Undercover Scot. Should be the title.
And there's a movie right there. Undercover Scot.
He whips off his, you know, he's got Velcro trousers. He whips it off. He's got a kilt underneath. Whole time.
Okay. At Lord Hodgkinson asks, what was your favourite shot from a film all year, or of all time for that matter? No, my friend, this is a review of the year, not a review of all years. This year, favourite shot.
Oh my god.
Is it cheating to have that 12 minute shot?
Yeah, gravity opening shot, the bit where the camera goes inside a helmet and the music gets a point of view and it comes out, or the bit where she gets her suit off and curls up in a little fetal position. Any of those? The whole film. The whole of Gravity.
I mean, in terms of most beautiful images, I mean, Lincoln is gorgeous. Again, I'm bringing up Lincoln, I'm sorry, but it has that sort of Velázquez kind of style about it. The lighting in that is absolutely beautiful. Yeah. Obviously, Janusz Kaminski, Spielberg's now regular cinematographer responsible for that, but it's a gorgeous, gorgeous looking film, even aside from everything else that's good about it.
Yeah.
What else?
Well, since you just mentioned Oblivion, there's an amazing shot in that. Of the swimming pool during a storm. That's really stuck in my head since I saw it. Didn't love the film overall, but there was some... Kaczynski is amazing at sort of getting great shots. So I would put that forward.
I'd also put Superman flying straight up in Man of Steel. That's a gorgeous shot. It's only very, very quick. It's actually longer in the trailer.
But I agree. As much as I'm not a fan of Man of Steel, it has amazing visuals. Who can forget Russell Crowe just getting onto a winged dragon and riding off? Yeah, that's a fantastic shot. My favorite shot of the year. I think there's some fantastic shots in. Nebraska is a beautiful film.
Mm. Yeah.
Fantastic black and white photography in that one. My favorite shot of the year is probably in The Bling Ring. It's a long shot, a holding shot, just one shot as the bling ring
from outside the house.
Yeah.
That is a great shot.
And I believe that was shot by the late DP Harris Yulin, to whom the film is dedicated. So there you go.
I'm going to volunteer Bomber's Barrel Rampage in Smaug, which I know I saw pretty recently, but I think I'd be saying that if I'd seen the film a year ago. Amazing.
That was really good fun. Walter Mitty made me want to go to Iceland. That was some gorgeous, gorgeous
shots. The shop
shots.
Or the...
No, the
how,
other one.
How many films popcorn. Were shot in Iceland this year? Oblivion, yeah. Thor, it's not until next year, but Interstellar shot in Iceland as well this year.
Very good tax rebates.
Mm.
They give you free herring.
Okay, we got a question here from @a_shrubbery.
A shrub boy.
A shrubbery. You must cut down the mightiest tree in the forest with a herring! Who asks, with so many sequels, redos, and adaptations this year, what has been your top original film of 2013?
Gravity.
Gravity.
Moving on. Captain Phillips for me. Gravity.
That's not original.
I wasn't.
That's
as...
not original.
What do you mean it's not original?
It's based on real events.
It's an original film.
It's based on
books.
It's original.
Based on a book.
I'm going to say Frances Ha.
All right.
Throw that out there. Hasn't had any love yet.
Okay, Frances Ha. All right. Mother all right. Effers. All is lost.
Yeah.
Shove that up your crack pipe.
Mud.
Mud.
Mud. Although it's loosely based on...
A mud.
Twain. No, Mud. Mud, that counts as original.
Mud.
And Before Midnight, maybe. Oh, it's a sequel. Never mind, carry on.
Good Day to Die Hard.
What? No.
World's End? Not a sequel-ish, sort of.
Yeah, part no,
of
it's a, not. It's not. It is original.
It is
original. It is.
Part of a sequence, but not a sequel.
I guess Blue Jasmine doesn't really count, because it's no, Streetcar Named Zoe.
Yes, it is.
Except Woody says it's not, so hey.
Oh
really? Oh, Woody says it isn't, and oh yeah, who are we? Who are we to in any way judge?
Stop being a Woody hater.
I don't hate Woody. I love Midnight in Paris.
Here's a question from @rich_chepson, who asks: biggest disappointment of the year? Man of Steel gets my vote. Can I just say I'm not Rich Chepson? But yes.
Oh God. Well, we've already talked about some, haven't we? I'd say let's leave Star Trek alone now. But I was disappointed by Elysium.
Mm-hmm. Likewise.
Which was a shame, because about 10 minutes into that film, I genuinely thought it was going to be my favourite film of the year. I was just watching, just going, this is just awesome.
I think I know exactly at what point that left your mind.
Go on.
Was it the point where it had a flashback to young Max?
Yeah.
With lots of sun-dappled shots of going,
and the
nuns turned up.
And the nun, yeah.
Yeah, I... Definitely Elysium for me. I love District 9. That was my favourite film of the year when it came out. And I could not wait for Elysium. I was sure it was going to be in my top 10 of the year. And it is not.
Mm.
Although there is plenty of good stuff in it.
Yeah. I'm just saying this is it. This is disappointing. It's kind of like what I said at the very beginning about expectation.
It's just a shame that District 9 had such a streamlined, propulsive story that just was constantly pushing forward. And I think Elysium... personally, I don't think they should have gone to Elysium until the end of the film.
Mm.
I think they should have stayed on Earth, and then we get there with Max.
Yeah.
But instead, it kind of goes all over the place.
It was just really easy to get to.
Yep.
Get in a shuttle, fly up there, and land.
Yep.
Seems like it happens every week.
Yep. Get chased around by a few robots.
Yeah.
Benny Hill style.
Yeah. And people that just disappear for no good reason.
It did probably have 2013's best screen death, although it then cheats by making it a not death. But when
that's ruining it.
I'd say the year's best death comes from another slightly disappointing film, The Counselor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Any advances on screen death? We've gone off the beaten track, but that's
screen deaths.
Screen deaths.
Well, I mean, Pierce Brosnan gets his head punched off in The World's End.
But he's not really alive to start with.
No, but it's still great.
Mm.
It's Pierce Brosnan getting his head punched off by Nick Frost. That's pretty cool.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, fair play.
Disappointing films. I mean, Wolverine, I wasn't, you know, they talked such a great game, and that was going to be the Wolverine film that everyone was waiting for. It wasn't. Although it had good stuff in it. The first 20 minutes is pretty great. Oz the Great and Powerful.
Oh, yeah.
I think disappointing just because Sam Raimi is capable of so much. And I keep forgetting that film even exists. I mean, it wasn't terrible, but it's just nothing.
Mm.
It's boring.
I have to say, I had a lot of problems with Oz the Great and Powerful, but James Franco was just such the wrong casting for that part, I thought. I mean, originally it was going to be Robert Downey Jr., wasn't it? Mm. And I can imagine him working really well in that role. I think he could have turned it around.
It's also, Oz was a magical kingdom, if you will, which always had a really big, strong cast of female characters, and they actually always drove the story. And here they're waiting around, sitting on their hands, for some bloke with no magic powers to turn up and tell them what to do, which is a little bit offensive.
That is
and
true.
Kind of the opposite of everything that Oz, you know, not just Dorothy, but Ozma and the witches and everybody else. So yeah, it's an odd film that. I'd add in, as disappointments go, After Earth, which I think is one of those films which had potential. I mean, I know that Shyamalan has been off his game recently, but we're always hoping that he'll be back on it. I think he had, you know, when he came in to talk to us about it on the podcast, he clearly had things he was trying to say with the film. He'd clearly put a lot of thought into the history of this world and how it got to this point. And, there'd been some real analysis done there. Mm. And the thing is, none of that matters if you don't care about the characters and the story of the actual film itself. And that was the case here.
Take a knee, Helen. Take a knee.
I'm sorry. Thanks.
I was personally a little bit disappointed by Red Dawn, because that's been... I know that, you know, nobody was that excited about it coming, but it was Dan Bradley doing his first film. And Dan Bradley obviously is the genius stunt choreographer. I kind of thought, you know, there could be some amazing action in this film. And there wasn't any. So that's kind of sad. I don't know if he's going to make another one.
Probably not, given that it absolutely died at the box office. It was delayed for 2 or 3 years. Not its own fault, of course. It was caught up in the MGM financial meltdown. But yeah, bit of a shame that, really. And of course it had the year's most egregious bad guys, didn't it, really, where they started off as Chinese and then they changed them via CG to North Korean. What?
I'd like to think there's just a button on the keyboard that you just tap F8 and shift.
Yeah.
And North Koreans
what is going on?
The increasing importance of China, the world box office, is really beginning to make itself felt, and it's having some very odd results on Hollywood's behaviour, and that was just one of the oddest so far. Mm. But, you know, obviously Iron Man 3 having a completely different cut in China with more Chinese characters is another example. And we're going to see more of this kind of in the next year or two. I mean,
Transformers.
You know, Transformers with a lot of it shooting in China as well. So, yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see how that kind of plays out. And potentially not necessarily good if it means that Hollywood filmmakers are kind of censoring themselves to appeal to a Chinese market.
Question from @MarkCWarner. He says, 2012 with the repairing of Sam Mendes and Daniel Craig, 2013 Shane Black and Robert Downey Jr. Which director could use a now popular star to reteam with for a career boost?
Whoa.
M. Night Shyamalan and Will Smith. Wait,
M. Night Shyamalan and Mark Wahlberg. No.
M. Night Shyamalan and Bruce. Tricky. Basically, this is about which stars are big enough now to get a director that they worked with back in the day to revitalize their career.
Okay.
So who are the biggest
stars? Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah.
And John Sayles.
Good.
I'd like to see them two reteam, because if you remember, I'll explain this.
Yeah.
Lone Star was the John Sayles film that pretty much introduced Matthew McConaughey to the world, playing the father of the main character in Flashback. And his scenes in Lone Star were absolutely amazing. And McConaughey's career took off. Off the basis of that.
Took off.
And I loved John Sayles, and he hasn't made a movie in bloody ages. So I really want to see John Sayles back, make a movie, star McConaughey, off we go, bish bash bosh, I'm happy.
Perhaps in the new year.
Perhaps.
The new year Sayles.
Peter Jackson's not doing quite so well these days, so Jeffrey Combs, a reunion there, I reckon, could be good.
That is the most Nick answer to that question I could possibly have imagined.
Well, sorry, I'm Nick.
And that's the most Nick answer to that question you could have possibly... Jeffrey Combs.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I'm being slightly facetious.
I can see that.
But, you know,
I can see that.
Frighteners too. Why not?
But yeah, that's the other way around, isn't it? That's a director who's become huge.
I guess
it works.
I've misunderstood.
Sam Raimi with Bruce Campbell is always would be my thing.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you think...
You're not over that yet.
Do you think Evil Dead 4 will happen?
Evil Dead 4 slash Army of Darkness 2? I don't know. I don't know if I wanted to. I'll be honest. I'd love to, you know, obviously, if it does happen, Bagsy is safe as it. But, and I'd be really, really excited if it does happen. But at the same time, I've seen enough movies revisit classic characters 20, 30 years down the line and disappoint. Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal
Skull. Oh my goodness, Christ, that's really bad.
Skull.
Just think of The Hustler instead. No, think of The Colour of Money instead.
Yeah, that's true. You know? That's true. Yeah, that would be good. I'd love to see De Niro and Scorsese work together again. I know they're talking about it. I know they're talking about this Hitman film.
I think it'll happen. But, yeah. Which is Pacino, De Niro, Pesci, and Scorsese. This has got to happen.
This has got to happen.
Wow, I hope he's as good as Righteous Kill.
I'd like to see Jennifer Lawrence help Deborah Granik get something made. That was, of course, the Winter's Bone director. She hasn't done anything since. It historically has been difficult for even successful indie female directors to get their second film off the ground or their next film off the ground. And, you know, that was a great film. I'd like to see her do more.
Amazing.
Well done.
Summer's Bone.
Summer's Bone. Hooray.
It should be four films. It should be Spring's Bone next. Summer's Bone will be the third in the series. Okay. And then what's the last one?
Autumnal Bone.
Very good.
@_Geordie asks, what's the biggest WTF moment of the year? What the fuck does WTF mean? Nick, you and I disagree on this slightly, but I thought that was a great joke in World's End. I'm surprised it's taken so long for someone to make a what the fuck does WTF mean joke. But here we are in the year 2013.
That's a good joke.
It's a good joke.
It's a really good joke.
I like that joke. For me, the WTF moment of the year has to be the Britney Spears moment in Spring Breakers, where James Franco plays Britney Spears every time. Her greatest song, by the way, on a grand piano.
How's it go?
It's a very difficult tune to sing. Yeah, I can't.
Well, James Franco managed it.
Not really, because it takes over in the soundtrack. While three ladies dressed in pink balaclavas with bikinis and twirling AK-47s dance around him. A bit like the X Factor final in so many ways.
It's not a good WTF moment, but in The Family, there is a bit where... I'm saving you all from watching The Family. There's a bit where Robert De Niro's character is invited to a screening of a movie, which turns out to be Goodfellas.
Yes.
So De Niro sits and watches himself in Goodfellas, but there's no sort of moment where he goes, ooh, he looks familiar. I just couldn't wrap my head around what they were trying to do there. It's dreadful.
It's an utterly, utterly dreadful film. Well, we'll be talking about our worst films of the year very soon, but yeah, I think that's up there.
I've got one, but I'm almost hesitating because I wouldn't forgive myself if we got to the end of this Review of the Year podcast without mentioning Stories We Tell, which was my favourite film of the year until I saw Gravity, and which really seems to have just not been seen by enough people. So it's a WTF moment in that, but I'm thinking maybe I shouldn't say what it is, because if not many enough people have seen it, perhaps I shouldn't give it away.
Does it ruin the plot?
It's not that the film doesn't have a plot, it's a documentary.
Go on, tell us.
All right, okay. Well, if you really want to see Stories We Tell, then don't listen to this next bit. But it's the moment where I suddenly realised that I wasn't actually watching home video footage. And it was actually all staged and shot by Sarah Polley, using actors playing her own parents. And even though she had put it together with actual real footage and there was slight physical differences, I hadn't realised. And it was when I suddenly realised that I wasn't watching the film that I thought I was watching. Mm. And it wasn't actually the documentary I thought I was watching when it started. And it's such a clever film. So subtle and sensitive, and that really nailed it for me. I was just like, okay, I've never seen anything like this before. And that was WTF.
Wow, indeed. We do have a list of these on the site, so I won't repeat everything there. The one that I didn't put on there, because I didn't want to harp on about it endlessly, is the end of Riddick. And the general attitude shown towards women in the second half of that film, which really gets my back up. There's a very long blog about this on the site, so I'm not going to go into it too much, but it was I was having a good time, I was enjoying watching this sci-fi movie, and then it just completely lost me to a degree that few movies have ever managed to alienate me.
Again, a great sort of opening to a movie. I really enjoyed the first 15 minutes of that, when it was just kind of Life of Pi, but with Vin Diesel beating up different alien animals.
So automatically better than Life of Pi.
Yeah, exactly. Can I give a quick preview of a 2014 WTF moment, which is a film I just saw the other day, Under the Skin, the new Jonathan Glazer film?
Yeah.
There is a scene in that, which I'd forgotten until about an hour ago, where Scarlett Johansson and a bloke takes her character home and puts on Tommy Cooper. And so you have Scarlett Johansson sitting in a Glaswegian house as an alien watching Tommy Cooper.
Mm.
That's got to be hard to beat.
Mm. That's a WTF film.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah.
I hope the exact same thing happens in Avengers 2. That would be absolutely amazing. Question from RJ Moffat, who asks, are there any scenes, characters, or lines that are destined to become unforgettable? That's a nice little question that covers off quite a lot of stuff. I guess let's talk first about our scene of the year or our moment of the year. What's the standout for you, Dan? Let's start with you.
The scene of the year. It feels really obvious to say Iron Man 3, The Mandarin, but it is pretty much, it was our magazine's classic scene of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Just very clever, I thought, in this way that following the Avengers, you know, they kind of ramped it up and ramped it up and ramped it up. And it's like, for the first Marvel movie after the Avengers, what bad guy can you have? What scenario can you have? And so the idea that they played on the Mandarin being this super, super, super villain, and also casting Ben Kingsley as well, who, let's face it, you know, tends to get cast in those kinds of roles quite a lot, and then undercutting it in the way that they did, I just thought was really smart. So there's that. And the other one I'm going to say, which actually personally pips it, is the story of the shark and the octopus in Short Term 12. Is a beautiful, beautifully written, amazing scene. It's a kid in this home for troubled children who writes this story and tells it to Brie Larson's character. And it's an amazing story, but obviously you get the history of that kid through the story. So that's my personal scene of the year.
Yeah, I'll second the Mandarin. Genius casting, like you said, because you expect him to be this sort of hardcore kind of dude.
Yeah.
In the same way that elsewhere in the film, they did not terribly good casting with Miguel Ferrer being the surprise villain as the vice president. As soon as you see Miguel Ferrer on screen, you're like, yeah, he's a bad dude. The Impossible, the tsunami sequence, and the barrels. I'm going to keep saying the barrels.
The barrels.
I love the barrels.
The barrels in The Impossible.
Yes.
For me, probably scene of the year. Yeah, I've been the tank for Marvel, as you guys know. I love that Mandarin scene. I also love the fact that he's a Liverpool fan, which is a big boost for me. It was good to see. The game he's watching is actually from last year's Liverpool 3, Chelsea 0, I believe. I'll look it up. But yeah, it's a Liverpool-Chelsea game from last year, and the goal scorer at the time, I believe, is Anil Agger. So there you go.
Wow.
Bit of trivia for you guys. And the reason that they're watching the Liverpool game is because Ben Kingsley insists that Trevor Slattery is Liverpoolian. Doesn't necessarily sound like it, but then again, I'm sure his accent's been eroded over the years. Helen?
I'd third or fourth Slattery, obviously. I'd again mention the opening sequence of Gravity. I would also, however, like to shout out to the final scene of Captain Phillips, which I think is an absolutely brilliant moment of humanity.
Yeah.
And similarly, you know, well, virtually anything in Lincoln, but particularly, maybe this is my lawyer training coming out, but his explanation of why the Emancipation Proclamation is not enough on its own and he needs the 13th Amendment. As a lawyer, that's just an absolutely brilliant piece of circular reasoning, and it's just wonderful, and that really made my day. So that, sorry.
That's right.
Scariest moment, I would volunteer the bit in The Conjuring, the hide and seek game, which was fairly horrible.
Yeah.
There's kind of a thing with Lee Whannell and James Wan, creepy cupboards. I wonder if one of them was traumatized by a wardrobe when they were small.
Yeah.
There's always horrible things happening in their cupboards.
I'd love to have them on the podcast one day. We can ask them that.
They can hide in a cupboard and jump out of them.
I thought it was a decent year for horror. We had You're Next and Insidious Chapter 2, which I really, really liked. I know it defied a lot of people. And I really liked Fede Alvarez's remake of... except it's not a remake, is it? His Evil Dead.
Yeah, that was fun. For Scaria, I know it's not a horror movie at all, but Upstream Colour is quite creepy and gets under your skin a little bit. And those early scenes of someone basically completely losing their willpower and doing whatever they're told by another person are really quite disturbing. So I still don't know what happened, but I'm pretty sure that was part of it.
Is Tommy Cooper featured in that film at any point?
He might be. I mean, who knows, honestly. But it's one of those films which I quite enjoyed not understanding.
Mm-hmm. I think we should probably mention the Battle of Hong Kong in Pacific Rim, which I thought was one of the greatest set pieces of the year. And I think really showed what Guillermo del Toro was striving for in that film. I don't think he achieved it entirely for the whole of the movie. Certainly if there's a sequel, I'd be very intrigued to see that. World War Z has some great set pieces. What I love about that film, really took me by surprise how much I liked that film, was the final sequence, which pares everything down and puts the emphasis on tension rather than on carnage. And I really liked that.
And that's a great model, actually, for blockbusters. I mean, I know they did that partly, you know, out of necessity in that case, having shot a big finale that didn't work. But, you know, I think that and Iron Man 3, and to some extent even Thor as well, sort of shows you don't need to make everything huge for the last action scene. You can kind of, well, maybe not Thor, it was a slightly different thing, but you can do something completely different for the last action scene. You don't need to do what you did before, but bigger. You can keep changing it up.
It's probably my one problem with Iron Man 3, that stuff at the end. I didn't think they needed it. I loved that film up to the point where they start exploding stuff. Although I like seeing all the suits, but it went on a bit.
I think there's a great ingenuity to the way that they keep diving from suit to suit, and each suit has a different purpose. And
it was spectacular, but after, you know, one of the nice things about that film is that he gets out the suit and it's like a caper almost. You know, he's being a bit MacGyvery.
It's interesting how it defies of Iron Man 3 is. I mean, it is so far at time of recording the biggest film of the year, and I think it's going to stay that way. But a lot of people I know didn't like it at all, and my immediate inclination is to yell you're an idiot at them, but they do seem to they weren't happy with the sort of what they saw as the mocking tone, and some people weren't happy with the amount of time that Tony Stark spends out of the suit in that movie, but I thought it pretty much got it spot on, to be honest. Also, one of the moments of the year for me is the Dobby song from Anchorman 2 The Legend Continues, which Adam McKay says is the dividing line for a lot of people. You like that scene, which means you like the movie, or you think it's one of the worst things ever committed to film. I loved it. But there you go. The Dobby song. Dobby the Shark.
Dobby the Shark. Song. Oh, yeah.
A song about a great white shark. The only thing that might have improved Jaws, one might argue. Question from R.J. Moffat. Are there any scenes, characters, or lines that are destined to become unforgettable? Let's focus on characters now. Anything? Who's going to become unforgettable from the cinematic year? Dan.
Unforgettable may be a bit strong, but I was really impressed by the character of Loki, Detective Loki.
Trickster.
Yes.
God of mischief.
Yes, I should say, I do love Loki, but it's the other Loki of the year, I thought was a really interesting character. It is kind of, I don't know whether this was Gyllenhaal putting things into the performance or whether it was in the script, but there's so much about that guy that you don't know, that you never find out. So he's got these weird tattoos, and he kind of obviously lives alone, and he kind of has this thing where he buttons his shirt up and he doesn't have a tie, and he seems really uncomfortable all the time. And I'd actually like to see another film with him in it.
I want to see a film that's just him smashing keyboards. He really smashes a keyboard.
I wouldn't rule that out. Well, I might rule Nick's idea out, but I wouldn't rule your idea out, because he and Denis Villeneuve, who directed that film, have already worked together twice, and both rave about the other, and I think have more to say. I mean, that character that Gyllenhaal talked a little bit about in our video interview, which is up on the website, and talked about, it's very much a conscious decision to have him buttoned up, and they did have a whole sort of history worked out where he actually was raised in a Catholic boys' home, so he's got those religious tattoos. Those are angelic symbols on his hands, so he uses his fist to protect people is the kind of idea, and always wears, I think, a crucifix as well. So it's all very kind of, there's a lot of kind of Catholic symbolism, or not even all Catholic, mystical symbolism built into the character, and a real sense of kind of faith and goodness beneath that kind of simmering anger, which it's a really, really interesting figure. You're absolutely right.
I will say he needs to spend a bit more time working on his suspect tailing. He's really terrible at following people in a car. But a great film, really good film. Characters.
I mean,
I'm not going to be able to forget Nicole Kidman in The Paperboy anytime soon. I don't know if that's a good thing or not. With the immortal line, if anyone's going to piss on him, it's going to be me.
Who hasn't said that at some point in their lives? Speaking of Nicole Kidman, Stoker, I can't remember if Stoker was in my top 10 of the year. I think it was. It's three great characters in that film, but Matthew Good's Uncle Charlie really stood out for me. Fantastic actor, Matthew Good, hasn't really probably had the career that he might have had. I mean, I think in the past he's auditioned for the likes of Superman and whatnot, but yeah, he's fantastic in that film. I'm going to give a shout out as and cover off an unsung hidden gem, if you will, of the year, Good Vibrations, which came out in March. Very, very small Northern Irish movie about a real life record store owner / DJ / talent scout called Terry Hooley, played by Richard Dormer. Fantastic performance, very effervescent character, the sort of guy. He grows up, but he's living at the height of the Troubles, and he literally doesn't care. He doesn't care about either side. He just wants to get on with his life, which I think reflects the life's hell in, if I'm right in thinking, of pretty much every single person in Northern Ireland,
Absolutely.
With the exception of a noisy few.
Yes, I would add in terms of characters of the year, Gary King, I think, in The World's End. It's a character that the more you think about him, the more layers there are to him.
Yeah, and again, a very divisive character. I know a lot of people who really had problems with that character.
I think the issue, I think, is he's not as immediately sympathetic as, you know, as Sean or as Nick Angel, but he has a lot going on. And I think the more you watch that film, that's a film, actually, that I think people's opinions are going to...
People
have high opinions of it already. I think they're going to get higher and higher, that film, the more people think about it. Emma Thompson's terrific in Saving Mr. Banks. That's honestly a character for the ages, but it cheats a bit by being based on a real person, I suppose. And then I loved R in Warm Bodies, Nicholas Holt's character in that. I think it's a really charming, very funny performance in Warm Bodies.
I'm going to cheat as well, given that you have... this is a real guy because it's a documentary, but Jiro Oni from Jiro Dreams of Sushi, which is on Netflix. If you have Netflix, watch that. It's one of the year's best documentaries. And he is an 86-year-old Japanese guy who is obsessed with seafood and sushi in all its forms. And Bruce Willis actually mentioned, when I asked him earlier in the year when I interviewed him if he'd seen anything good this year, he loves that film. So, you know, if Bruce says... Bruce is never wrong, and he's never in a bad film. So, yeah.
It has been a cracking year for documentaries. We should give a shout out to the likes of Blackfish, which a lot of people
which is amazing.
Yeah,
and The Gatekeepers, which is astonishing, and Stories We Tell, which I haven't mentioned for 5 minutes.
Act of Killing.
Yeah. The Deep, which is very interesting.
Leviathan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a weird art house documentary. That's a whole new dawn for documentaries, that one.
Jiro probably loves that.
Probably.
Just plotting how he can catch everything.
Those fish.
And cook it. But characters, gosh. I mean, The Counselor is one of those weird films that's I kind of liked it. Because it's hard to forget Cameron Diaz's character in that. That's a WTF, WTF moment, if ever there was one, involving the car.
True.
But there's several characters in that film that are kind of indelible and original. So, yeah.
Dr. King Schultz, Django Unchained.
Rob Lowe, Behind the Candelabra.
Oh, yeah, brilliant character. Mm. Yeah, fantastic. And one of the comedy performances of the year from Rob Lowe as well. I know this is on at the moment on the Empire website, empireonline.com. We have a huge, expansive review of the year. This is one of those categories, but that's very, very quickly go through our lines of the year.
I hate space.
I'll pay you in Never You Worry, which is a line spoken in Broken City. I have no idea.
I'm not sure that's a line. Does that even count as English? What is that?
It's probably the line I've quoted the most.
I'll pay you in Never You Worry. Astonishing stuff. And get your bleeps out, earmuffs, because of that great line from the end of The World's End. Why don't you get in your rocket ship and fuck off back to Legoland, you cunts?
I would like to shout out again to Warm Bodies, because the idea of a zombie internally monologuing, don't be creepy, don't be creepy, don't be creepy, when hitting on a girl is one of the most delightful moments of the year for me.
How have we not mentioned Ben Whitley's A Field in England, one of our best and most prolific directors? The Devil is an Irishman is a line from that. And you talk about what the fuck moments of the year. Reese Shearsmith emerging from the tent with the most terrifying expression I've seen in anyone's face for a long, long time, and I'm including yours right now, Dan, is an indelible image of the year and will stick in my mind for a very, very long time indeed. And that film is fantastic.
I've totally failed to mention, and you won't believe it, Much Ado About Nothing. I haven't mentioned it this whole time. It's Joss Whedon and Shakespeare, and I haven't mentioned it.
There's a couple of good lines in that, aren't there?
So there are just one or two good lines in that one. But also Benedict and Beatrice, Amy Acker and Alexis Denisov do a really good job of those characters. So a big shout out to them for characters of the year.
One word. Jizlam.
Psychic Simon?
Psychic Simon, okay, that line. Character.
John Harrison, a.k.a. Khan Noonien Singh, was by some distance the best thing about Star Trek Into Darkness, I thought, and Benedict Cumberbatch was excellent. And also, if you're shouting out about people who've had a good year, he's had a bit of a belter, hasn't he, really?
He has.
Old Cummerbund.
He topped our 100 sexiest movie stars poll.
Did for he?
The in the men's leg, anyway, yeah.
And of course, he was Smaug.
Yep. He's about to be back as Sherlock.
Yeah.
He recited R. Kelly lyrics. I mean, what more could you ask for? And please, if you haven't already, do Google Benedict Cumberbatch, R. Kelly.
Wasn't it this time last year when people were hopelessly head over heels in man love with Ryan Gosling, who had a bit of a squiffy year this year? Only God Forgives is possibly my worst film of the year. We'll get on that in a second. But also Gangster Squad was god-awful. God-awful.
Terrible film. And he's and the voice that he chooses to go with. You can see, you can kind of imagine, he's like, yeah, I'm going to try this, I'm going to do this. What do you think? Shall I go with this? Yeah, let's do this. And he has the most irritating voice of any character all year.
Yeah, it's like Mickey Mouse in a gangster suit. It's not good.
No.
It's not good.
Have we got time for one more line?
Yes!
Zartan, played by Jonathan Pryce in G.I. Joe Retaliation. You know, they call it a waterboard, but I never get bored.
Oh...
How can that not put a smile on your face?
Oh, amazing.
Jonathan Pryce.
Fast and Furious 6. Was it? We need a plan B.
Plan A,
we need a plan C, D and E. We need more alphabets.
Yeah. So gratuitous.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
See, that's probably the only time that movie approached the levels of stupidity, self-aware stupidity, that Fast Five had.
Yeah.
Which is a bit of a shame.
Yeah. I'd like to think that they do go off and invent new alphabets in between missions. And they're just sitting
if
there.
If anyone can do it, it's ludicrous. Who knows? It's been a good year in the podcast. I mean, you know, we've had a fantastic guest on this year: Arnold Schwarzenegger, Harrison Ford, Denzel Washington, Mark Wahlberg, Daniel Radcliffe, you know, Mark Strong's been on here, Ryan Reynolds. It's been fantastic, and you guys have been, the listeners have been fantastic because you've really helped the show grow from week to week, and we're very, very grateful for that. Thank you for listening
and for all your questions. Thank you.
Indeed. Thanks for making it interesting for us every single week. Let's round this off now, though, with our films of the year, worst. Len Best, very, very quickly, Danforth Jolin, worst film of the year.
G.I. Joe Retaliation.
Why?
Because it was offensive and preposterous and badly made. There is literally nothing good that I can say about it. And sorry, I love The Rock. I love The Rock, but he was just wasted.
Yeah,
he was wasted. He wasn't, you know, I'm not saying he was on drugs. I'm saying he was wasted.
It's a nothing role in a nothing movie, sadly. He has that good bit with the mountain and the ninjas are on the mountain. And Jonathan Pryce is fantastic in it. You at least have to admit that.
They call it a waterboard.
No.
But I just get bored.
I won't even give you the ninjas.
That's a dreadful impression. Oh my word. What was that? We'll come back to best. Nick, worst film of the year.
How can I choose between The Family and A Good Day to Die Hard? How?
Go The Family.
The Family.
Go The Family.
Okay. All right. It's just awful. I mean, I would think it was made by someone who hates French people, except it's made by a French person. And it's just, the casting is so...
You've seen Taken, right?
Huh?
I think Luc Besson has some issues.
Yeah, he does.
But, you know, it's coming up to the 20th anniversary of Leon, so... Yay!
It's a movie that's so bad it makes you forget. It's like one of those. Helen, you have this theory as well. You were watching The Love Guru and you said it's so bad it makes you doubt whether Mike Myers was funny in the first place. He was, thankfully, thank goodness. And I think he can be again.
I think what I hate most about it is that every actor is playing a part that's really close to something they've done brilliantly in the past. So De Niro is playing a mob guy. Michelle Pfeiffer is playing a mob mole. Tommy Lee Jones is playing a sort of fed, and it just makes you want to go out and watch any of those films.
But it also it makes you doubt they were good in the first place. And it makes you doubt Luc Besson as a great director in the first place. And you have to go back and watch Leon and, to a lesser extent, Big Blue in some way. But you have to go back, especially Leon. It's coming up to 20 years next year. And it is slightly tainted by The Family, which is probably the worst film of the year, but I'm still going to go with Only God Forgives because I've never looked at my watch more than in that movie.
It's crazy.
It's only 90 minutes long. It feels like it's 9 hours long. I was looking at other people's watches.
That was the one film that made both our best and worst lit films of the year, which I think is a good thing. And I think, frankly, Winding Refn would probably be very, very happy about that. I was more in the quite liking it camp.
I liked it, with the exception of the needly scene.
Oh, yeah, that was unpleasant.
Here's the weird thing about The Only God Forgives. It has some amazing sequences, some amazing shots, great performances, and technically it's fantastic, and yet I just hate it every second.
Well, there you go. I think my worst film of the year, I was tempted to say A Good Day to Die Hard as well, I'm going to go for the Mortal Instruments City of Bones because, you know, honestly, I was trying to cheerlead for it. I wanted it to be good. And it was really bad. So
still a sequel happening, isn't it?
There is apparently still a sequel happening. So we'll get to see the effect of Bach's music on demons, hopefully, in that. Apparently, they don't like it.
Because no performances are better than when actors are contractually obliged to come back for something that they
exactly.
don't want to do.
Exactly. So that's going to be really good fun.
Yay. And best film of the year, Helen.
Well, I said Lincoln on the list, so I'm going to stick with that. I am very tempted by the likes of Gravity, Captain Phillips, and All Is Lost, but I've got to stick with my first answer.
Okay. Nick?
Yeah, I'm going to be dull and say Captain Phillips. You know, it's making a list is so kind of arbitrary, number one. I mean, I could put Stoker at number one, I could put Gravity at number one, I could put Captain Phillips. It'd be one of those ones.
Yeah, it literally is. It's just whatever you're feeling on the day. Mm-hmm. For example, I put Captain Phillips and then All Is Lost at number two. I don't know. Do I really prefer Captain Phillips to All Is Lost? I put Iron Man 3, which is the film I've enjoyed most this year, at number 3. It's probably, hand on heart, my number one film of the year. But I'm such a comic book geek, I was probably aware of that and put Captain Phillips instead.
I don't know if Captain Phillips is going to be as rewatch worthy as, say, Gravity. I kind of feel like I've seen it and I'll maybe watch it again at some point. But that, you know, it was an experience. Mm. But, yeah.
Sir Isaac Newton's Gravity.
But I would like to put a shout out, and I don't know who it came from, I apologise. Somebody on Twitter described it as grabbing for handles, the movie, which is incredibly disrespectful, but also not unfair. I compared it at the VFX festival this year, and it was people who work in visual effects explaining mm-hmm. how they do it and what they do to mostly students of the craft or other professionals. And the Framestore team came along and talked about Gravity and talked about how they made that film. Yeah. And there were regular gasps from the audience when they explained what went into making Gravity. And on several occasions, the kind of disbelieving titter you get when people are just like, well, that's clearly impossible. What are you talking about? And it just brought home for me, because I understood about 20% of what was being said, that brought home to me just how impressive and how groundbreaking those visual effects were.
Tim Weber, visual effects supervisor.
He was, yes.
He's one of my unsung heroes of the year.
He's one of Empire's as well. He's going to be in our Empire Online roundup of the year, so look for him there.
Awesome.
Which you can read now if you so desire. It has lots of other unsung heroes. Hopefully Max Martini, if that interview happens. Max Martini, he was so good. And Captain Phillips and Pacific Rim as well.
Steve Coogan's brother.
Yeah, tons and tons of other
James
people.
James Badge Dale,
is he on the list?
No, he's not.
But he should be, because he's been in everything this year. Okay, very, very quickly to wrap up, let's rate 2013 out of 5 stars, as is the Empire tradition. Don't forget, 3 stars is a recommendation. Dan, out of 5, what would you give this year?
3 stars?
3 stars is a recommendation. Go and see it. Nick?
4 stars and then 3 stars on DVD.
Okay, Helen?
4 stars and I'm sticking with that on DVD, darn it.
I'm going to be very controversial and say 3 stars.
Why is that controversial? Dan already did it.
Which is a recommendation, listeners.
Absolutely.
Go and see this year.
And that is it for Empire's Review of the Year podcast special. Join us next year for more podcast year reviewing related fun. But also we'll be back on January 10th with the first podcast proper of 2014. Wow, the future.
Ooh.
It's amazing. Until then, have a very, very happy new year, listeners. It is goodbye from Helen.
Happy New Year.
It's goodbye from Nick.
See you in the future.
It's goodbye from Dan.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. Thanks. Bye.